Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Intellectual History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Hetty V. Williams, your host. Today on New Books in Intellectual History, we have Dr. Yung-Hsia Gao, who is a professor of history at Ryerson University in Toronto, Ontario, and author of Sporting Gender, Women Athletes, and Celebrity Making During China's National Crisis, 1931 to 1945, and more recently, Arise Africa, Roar China, Black and Chinese Citizens of the World in the 20th Century. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gao.
Thank you for having me here. Good morning.
Good morning. So nice to have you here with us today to talk about your latest book, Arise Africa, Roar China. I see this in many ways as both a cultural and intellectual history, because you talk about some of the leading intellectuals in the African-American experience, such as W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and Langston Hughes, including in this discussion their wives. First, we will discuss Dr. Gao's biography, research and teaching interest, and some thoughts on intellectual and cultural history, and then get into a more detailed discussion of her book. Dr. Gao, tell us a little bit about your research and teaching interests.
Sure. My research primarily focuses on trans-Pacific cultural and intellectual history throughout the 20th century. As you just mentioned, I wrote two books in this domain, and currently I'm working on two biographies of actress of Chinese descent, modeling a trans-nationalized Asian and Asian American history. And so I teach modern Chinese history and also the global interactions of the East and the West, including the Mongol Empire. And so also I teach film and history. I would love to teach a course about Asia-Afro interactions incorporate all the new cutting-edge scholarship in this area.
Yes, yeah, very exciting research. And I even would say your research really goes into, you know, multiple areas, world history, intellectual, cultural history. And it's just a very fascinating study, I think, that really, it's a book that can be used, I think, in various courses. You know, if we were looking at a course on African-American intellectual and cultural history, I think it's a useful source in that way.
Thank you.
So how did you come to study history? Why history?
So, put a long story short, back in the days when I was a high school student in China, and students were asked to choose two divisions. One is the science, one is social science. One was science. The other one was social science and humanity. Obviously, I chose social science and humanity. Then after the few passed the challenging national exam to interest to college, and their students were allowed to register your choice, but just only for reference, not guaranteed they're going to assign you to what you want to study. So my choices were pretty limited, including history, political science, and Chinese language and literature. So I followed my passion and chose history because my father was a school teacher who taught history. And so I was granted my wish because history was not a popular major, you know, due to the perceived limited path to career. So a lot of my classmates, actually, who wished to be like a secretary, government worker, lawyers, they were actually assigned to the major against their preference. So that was the story.
That's a very interesting story there. So I think your work, as I said, it moves into several different subfields, though obviously it has a focus on culture. And I see intellectual and cultural history as having an obvious overlap, and you can kind of see that intersection in your work. Let's talk about the parallels between the two and or your own definition of intellectual and or cultural history.
So I think people have different understanding about, what intellectual history or cultural history. And so for me, intellectual history, I understand very broadly. Means the study of intellectuals and artists and thoughts and ideas, ideologies over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely agree with you. Intellectuals, their ideas and their thoughts over time, very much so. And the interaction, intellectual communities, right, that people circulate in. And it's definitely a similar definition that I have of this term.
Yeah, obviously, so, overlapping with the cultural history, as we talk.
Sure, yeah, sure. Especially if we're talking about artists and their ideas, yeah. We're also talking about, cultural production.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody recently on Twitter, I remember hearing or seeing someone raise a question about a student they had who asked about, a poem used as a primary source. And I said, why is that such, you have Langston Hughes in your book, and this person is asking a question about whether or not the student should use a poem as a primary source. And to me, as somebody who does intellectual history and that overlaps with cultural history, I said, of course,
I think I saw that. Yeah. Also, I saw some people using new kind of literature style to, reflect study history, graphic right. novels, right?
Sure. So discuss with us the premise of your text, Arise Africa, Roar China.
Oh, main subject of this book, if I just use one sentence to describe it, it is about the global interactions between the three most famous 20th century African Americans, W.E.B. Du Bois, Paul Robeson, and Langston Hughes. And their last known Chinese allies, and their names were Liu Liangmo. He was a prolific journalist, talented musician, and Christian activist. Okay, and another one was Sylvia Silan Chen. She was a Sino-Caribbean choreographer and dancer. Actually, she happened to be a daughter of Eugene Chen, China's Trinidad-born foreign minister in the 1920s. Okay.
So this is one question I wanted to add, just in turn, obviously you cover it in your book, but tell our audience how these individuals were able to meet. How, were these Black intellectuals able to meet, these various activists and cultural workers of Chinese descent? Did they meet them in their travels in the United States?
Okay, so that's a very good question. To put it in another way, why they were attracted to one another? How come they, they met and worked together? Okay, yeah, so for the three African-Americans, famed African-American cultural giants, of course they knew one another. They worked together, as we all know. So for Silan Chen, She had a global journey. She lived and traveled all over the places. Okay? And she lived briefly in China, following her father there. And after the revolution in 1927, the Northern Expedition, the revolution failed in 1927, and Chiang Kai-shek took over. So his father sent them, his siblings, four of them, to Moscow. And so they lived there for 10 years. And so in Moscow, she met Leslie Hughes. Probably some of our readers know Leslie Hughes traveled to Moscow in 1932 with a bunch of other African-American artists and actors, and supposedly to produce a film called Black and White on American racial relations. Hughes was assigned to write the script. The film collapsed, never made. But in Moscow, Leslie Hughes met Sun Chen and the Chinese community there. That propelled him to China. Okay, so by the way, they were lovers when they were in Moscow, Chen and Leslie Hughes. Okay, so that's how they met, how they fell in love. Okay, and so later on, Sun Chen married an American writer and film historian. His name was Jay Leda. So she migrated to U.S. and reconnected with Leslie Hughes and the rest of the world, the rest of the figures we talk about here. So back to the story about Liu Liangwu. How did Liu Liangwu, enter this circle? So he was from Shanghai. Okay, so he loved the mass singing movement in China, and then he moved, migrated to U.S. in 1941, stayed here for 10 years. So there. In New York City, he was introduced by the famous Chinese writer and philosopher Lin Yutang and to Paul Robeson. Okay, so they worked together, and they brought the mass singing movement across Pacific. And so, among many domains, Robeson and Liu collaborated, and including they recorded an album together called Qi Lai, New Songs of China. And so Qi Lai, later under a new name, Munch of Volunteers, became the national anthem of People's Republic of China. So what they did was to globalize this song. Okay. So that's one thing. And also they collaborated in many areas to help the war effort. So the mass singing movement was for war mobilization. And also Liu Liangwu and Robeson worked in many domains to help support China's anti-Japanese war. That's part of the Second World War. So then they worked in a close circle. Everybody knew one another and worked together in many meetings, forums, and they all came together.
Wow. It's just, I think, an important book that our listeners definitely want to pick up if they haven't already, because I think it just makes so many different interventions that overlap in different realms of history.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about the structure of your book, in terms of the setup of your book or layout, and then talk to us a little bit about methods, if you will.
Mm-hmm. So the book has an introduction, a brief introduction. After that, I divided them into five chapters, and one chapter for each figure. I call them the citizens of the world. Okay. The first chapter is called Arise Africa, Face the Rising Sun, W.E.B. at Sir Graham Du Bois. So this chapter basically focuses on the Du Bois connection and complex relationship with the Pan-Africanism and Pan-Asianism under different political turmoils by looking at their writings and comments on Asia and China and examining their trips, multiple trips, to Asia and China from 1936 to 1977. That's chapter one. So chapter two is called Arise, You Who Refuse to be Bound Slaves. So that is the opening sentence of the National Anthem of People's Republic of China. Okay. And so again, let me repeat the full title. Chapter two, Arise, You Who Refuse to be Bound Slaves, Paul Robeson, The Black King of Songs. So this chapter rediscovered Robeson's profound affection for China and his enthusiasm for China's resistance against Japan, his long-term friendship with leftist Chinese sojourner artists, including Liu Liangwu, and also the famed King of Beijing Opera, Mei Lanfang, for instance. Okay, and his eventual mutual embrace with the Communist Party of China and the People's Republic of China. Okay, so that's the second chapter. Third chapter, Trans-Pacific Mass Singing, Journalism, and Christian Activism, Liu Liangmo. So this chapter explores Liu Liangmo, how he initiated the mass singing movement across the Pacific, and also how he worked with Chinese-American, African-American, and white Americans during his decade journey in the United States from 1941 to 1949. And through means of speeches, music, and easy-to-access journalism. And finally, this chapter concludes how Liu Liangmo helped to bind Chinese Christianity with new ideology in the People's Republic of China as a high-level cultural official. He returned there in 1949. And so, fourth chapter is called Choreographing Ethnicity, War, and Revolution Around the Globe, Sylvia Sulanchen Leda. Okay. So this chapter unpacks Chen's long journey through the globe, including the Caribbean, Europe, China, the Soviet Union, and the United States as the first modern Chinese Soviet dancer. Okay, that's the fourth chapter. The final chapter, chapter five, Raw China, Lasting Hues, a poet laureate of the Negro race, explores the unique role Lasting Hues played as the first Black intellectual celebrity in China in connecting the liberation campaigns of Chinese and African Americans. So those are the five chapters. And then followed by an epilogue, briefly discusses the contemporary understanding of those five citizens of the world. So my approach, my method, as you can see, kind of biographical. And meanwhile, more importantly, it's transnational and transdisciplinary. So
yes, thank you so much for just laying the book out for us in terms of structure. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about your source material to tell the stories of these individuals, and particularly in terms of your primary sources, which I think is one of the more important, or most important anyway, aspects of your text, is the way you use sources and the sources that you uncovered that may have, I think, haven't really been assessed or utilized by other scholars.
So I think that's true, actually. I'm very proud of my exhaustive research, I would say. Actually, one of the anonymous reviewer of the book manuscript and commented, that my exhaustive research would enable this book to transform and redefine Afro-Asian studies. So what I did with my sources, I think this kind of transnational and transcultural history requires a fluent multilingual approach to comprehensively and thoroughly survey the massive yet rarely used sources. First, I checked each figure's archives, published and private, also FBI files, Immigration and Naturalization Service, called INS back then, records in numerous locations, and the manuscript holdings for prominent social institutions such as the United China Relief, and important figures such as Pearl Barker, the Nobel laureate. Okay. And also, I have combed through all the I think all relevant English language newspapers and other media published in the United States, in the Great Britain, and also in Shanghai. And also Chinese language periodicals published not only in China, but also in Chinatowns in the US from the 1930s to the present. And also, I have found numerous monographs and pamphlets on and by my subjects, written in or translated into Chinese. So those are my sources.
That's That's very important. I think some people may not want to hear that, but I think you're absolutely correct when it comes to doing history and getting at the primary sources in the original language. This fluent multilingual approach that you mentioned, I think if you're looking at Afro-Asian studies and you're looking at sources only from the one side and not being able to read those sources across languages, this I think it's important point to be made in terms of Afro-Asian studies or diaspora studies more broadly. I think that's just an important point. Maybe for any students listening to the show today and training in their own training and the PhD level and thinking about, you know, Afro-Asian studies. Let's turn to how your work engages the work of scholars writing, for instance, about Black internationalism and, you know, in an international or global framework. How do you see your work engaging the work of other scholars?
So that's a good question. Also, I think related to what we have discussed about sources. Okay. So for me, I think my book, you know, regarding the global transnational framework of Black internationalism, directly relevant is about, you know, is other scholarship on the interactions between the Black diaspora and Asia. There are excellent work, excellent scholarship in this domain. But so far, I think mostly just focused on how African Americans borrowed Chinese ideas and ideologies. Or sometimes even just briefly mentioned such context between the Black diaspora in China or Asia existed. I think, you know, they are good work, but limited by access of source. So barely used Chinese language sources. Yeah, so therefore, I think, you know, I build on this scholarship, expanded, you know, by integrating, both perspectives, right? The sources allow us to look at, you know, perspectives from different groups and different domains, okay? And so I think my book expanded the existing scholarship by examining how these famous three African Americans, they were studied and perceived and critiqued among the Chinese. Okay. And also, I introduced Liu Liangwo and Si Lancheng as brand new but very important subjects in this discourse. Okay. And so far, directly comparative works about these three African American cultural giants are rare. And discussions of individual Afro-Chinese relationships are even harder to find. Okay. So, but my book explores new directions, it opens new directions by examining the intertwined lives of these individuals, usually perceived as occupying non-overlapping domains. And so, how these citizens of the world actually interact with one another in very different ways. And sometimes they collaborated and contributed to historic partnerships. And other times they fell in and out of love. Okay, so that's how I engaged and expanded existing scholarship in this domain.
Can you talk a little bit, since we raised the question of sources?
Yeah.
And the Chinese language sources in particular, that's a great point as well. The fact that, you know, the Chinese are commenting on, right, their thoughts about these African-American intellectuals and culture workers. That's important to know, right? So if you don't have that language skill, right, there's going to be, you know, a gap in your knowledge. So how were African-American intellectuals such as Du Bois, Robeson, and Hughes perceived by the Chinese according to these Chinese language sources in particular?
Yeah, that's a very good question, but it's a very large question. Okay, it could cover many.
Yeah, sure. No, I
try to answer briefly. I will try to answer briefly. Okay. So basically, you know, Chinese perceptions of those intellectual giants sifted and evolved over time within the dynamic Trans-Pacific political and ideological landscapes. Just so you know, let me examine them, you know, one by one very briefly. First, for W.E.B. Du Bois, and when, in the 1930s, back then, and viewing Imperial Japan as the hope of the darker world. And so he dismissed Chinese nationalists, the official government, under Chiang Kai-shek. You know, he used the term called Asian archetypes. Everybody knows what it means. So therefore, in return, Chinese, despite the fact they understood as a giant stature of, you know, the giant intellectual stature of W.E.B. Du Bois, but they were alienated from him and even suspected him, you know, someone even questioned him whether you are a Japanese agent after all. Okay. So that was back then. And then Du Bois shifted his favorable gaze from Japan to the People's Republic of China as a new pillar of the colored world. Okay, then the People's Republic of China treated him as an icon and crucial to China's new aspiration to the leadership of the Third World. So therefore, he and his wife began to receive incomparable state hospitality. And so how they were treated, as you can learn from my book, they frequently rubbed shoulders with China's top leadership, as you can tell from the cover, he was talking with Mao, right? Du Bois was talking with Mao, and also other leaders, okay? And also, Du Bois and his wife were the first Westerners to appear on the Tiananmen Square podium during the National Day Parade. They frequently occupied the front page of the state media, like the Communist Party of China's mouthpiece, People's Daily. Okay, his birthdays were celebrated as state events. Okay, even there were documentary made about he and his wife their visit, so you can imagine how important they were. Okay. So that's Du Bois. For Paul Robeson, a little bit different story. And so back in Republican China, that is to say, you know, from 1911 to 1949, that's that period called Republican China. And especially in the 1920s and 30s, Paul Robeson was the most visible, although he never visited China, he was the most visible Black celebrity back then. Why? Because the contemporary media, Chinese media, rarely covered Black celebrities, but they made an exception for him, obviously, because of his global fame. However, his popular singing and acting fell into the category of entertainers, okay, where the stereotypical, quote-unquote, primitive African image were reinforced and celebrated. Okay. Then, in the People's Republic of China, so he was actually immediately after the establishment of the People's Republic of China, Paul Robeson was enshrined as a reliable friend of China, fearless and reliable friend of China. Okay. And he was promoted as a heroic revolutionary model to inspire socialist citizens of China. He was celebrated as the Black King of Songs for the oppressed masses across the world, who embodied actually the perfect marriage between art and politics. Okay, so that's the transition of his standards in China. And for Lasting Hughes, actually, he established the status as a revolutionary among the Chinese, or with the Chinese, like before W.E.B. Du Bois, before Paul Robeson. And during his epic journey and trip to Shanghai in 1933, he was immediately celebrated as the first established revolutionary black writer by the leftist cultural circle in Shanghai. Okay. And they celebrated and lauded how he screamed and struggled for all the oppressed races across the world. Okay. So his visit actually triggered an ongoing interest in his work and in general black literature in China. Okay. And so most tellingly, since 2009, and his one of his classical poem, and everybody knows Black Speaks, called Negro Speaks of River, okay? And the Chinese translation, as the Minister of Education of China, he included the translation of this poem in the Chinese language and literature textbook and mandated for ninth graders across the nation. Okay, that is to say, everybody goes through ninth grader, you have to read this piece, okay? And what's the purpose to include this piece? Yeah, so that the Chinese youth could learn about the Qin Dynasty history of the black race. As you can imagine, until now, Lasting Hughes enjoyed enormous readership among Chinese. So I think that's a brief story about how they were perceived by the Chinese.
Right. Mm-hmm. No, and that speaks again to the value of the Chinese language sources and also FBI sources, as you mentioned, you know, looking at their travels and how they get documented by the government, which I think anyone working in Black internationalism, studies of Black internationalism, they're probably mostly relying on, you know, government sources, FBI sources, if they don't have the secondary language skills, which is you're really mapping how this, you know, ultimately is not going to give you a complete or full picture of how these individuals were perceived in China. So I think that's a groundbreaking achievement of your work.
Mm-hmm. Talking about FBI files, actually, you know, all the, you know, we talk about citizens of the world, right? As if, you know, they were moving freely across the globe. Yes, they traveled, and travels were important to them, but, you know, not easy, okay? They were followed by the FBI. Yeah. Everybody, every subject in my book, and they had a huge pile of FBI files. Huge trail following them, okay? And I think it's something new in my work to see how FBI actually was working with other government agency, like in China, and, you know, also connected with Japan, with Japanese government. So it's a global network.
Right. So though your book focuses on Du Bois, Robeson, and Hughes, you also discuss Black women, and such as Islana Good Robeson and Shirley Graham Du Bois. What role do they play in this story, in this narrative? Tell us a little bit more about them in particular.
Mm-hmm. So that's a very good question. So, you know, all these subjects, the male subjects I talked about, they were not alone. Their spouses and romantic partners played a very important role in their ideologies and their careers, of course, and particularly in their interactions in quarters with China and Chinese. Okay. And so, for instance, you know, here I fully developed the story in this book about Silanchen. And during their brief romantic encounter, actually, she helped to fan Lasting Hughes' interest in China. And for instance, Lasting Hughes recorded how he spent a memorable time in the cozy room of Silanchen in Moscow, and their conversations frequently was about Chinese Revolution, about the Chen family, especially about Silanchen's father, Eugene Chen, the former foreign minister. Okay, and so that's how she helped him to connect with China, the whole network. Okay, so recording is like a Robeson, and Shirley Graham Du Bois, and so I included part of the story here, but I think their stories warranty independent scholarship, independent from this book project. And so I don't have enough room to include all their stories here. So I have been accumulating actually enough materials about them, their interactions with China and Chinese. So I'm planning a new project. Hopefully this new project would open new ground, you know, by adding, you know, the narratives about interactions between African-American women and China, particularly Chinese women.
So how do these women push their husbands? At one point you use this phrase, so the women push their husbands into an embrace of Chinese communism. And in what ways did somebody like a Shirley Graham Du Bois do this?
Okay, so that's a good question. All these women, actually, you know, you may be surprised, they were more radical than their husbands. Yeah, so go back a little bit, you know, although Sun Chen obviously was not the wife of Leslie Hughes, but you know, go back to their brief encounter, aromatic encounter in Moscow. Actually, Sun Chen not only helped him to develop interest in China, also helped him to connect with the international communist network and like connect with him with Madame Sun Yat-sen, the leftist sister of the China's contemporary first lady, Madame Chiang Kai-shek, and also with other figures, okay, and propelled him to Shanghai, the leftist cultural circle. Okay, so that's about Sun Chen and Leslie Hughes. And for Isleta Robeson, okay, and so as I mentioned, Robeson never traveled to China. But immediately after the founding of the People's Republic of China. And so who traveled there? And Robeson's wife, okay? And he appeared in the People's Republic of China in Beijing as the first group of foreigners ever stepped there, okay? So remember, at that point, so the rest of the world was not certain about how to respond to the new regime, to the new China, okay? So she traveled there to affirm the Robesons, I mean, the couple's alliances with the new regime, with the People's Republic of China, okay? So after she returned, she toured the U.S. and to laud the achievements of the People's Republic of China. That reform, how the nation looked prosperous, strong, harmonious, and egalitarian, okay? So, and this backed and reinforced Robeson's romantic image and romantic perception about the People's Republic of China. Okay, that is between Isleta Robeson and Paul Robeson. Okay, and so similarly, and when W.E.B. Du Bois started to embrace communist China, his wife Shirley Graham offered strong support. And so actually, since Graham Du Bois entered his life, and Du Bois' interest in Soviet Union and in communist China began to be translated into renewed interest of vision to socialism, okay? And so what Graham Du Bois did was to open up contacts and connections with China, overseas Chinese, and also with China, and to help lead to a better reception in China for the couple in the future. And so remember, the Chinese were not certain about Du Bois because of his, you know, position about Japan before, okay? And during the transition from the Republican China to the People's Republic of China around 1949. But at that point, so they knew about, understood Graham Du Bois' writings and also his politics. Okay, and so for instance, you know, Graham Du Bois' biographies of famous African Americans, including Paul Robeson and Frederick Douglass and George Washington Carver, were all translated into Chinese between 1949 and 1950. Okay, and also Chinese, the People's Daily, for instance, reported how Shirley Graham and Isleta Robeson, and they tore down Taiwan's flag in all Africa Conference in Ghana in 1958 to help beat down the two China conspiracy launched by the U.S. government. So I'm giving this example to show you how, you know, in the early days of the People's Republic of China, and they were watching, appreciating, understanding Sully Graham Du Bois. Okay. And so after, you would note, after Sully Graham entered Du Bois' life in the late 40s, early 1950s, and the Chinese media began to highlight the favorable position of W.E.B. Du Bois. Okay. So that's my answer.
So, no, very good, very comprehensive. You used the phrase, Shirley Graham Du Bois was a major interpreter of her husband's vision of China. What can you tell us a little bit more about that? A little expand.
Okay, sure. Yeah, I think I already touched, but here, you know, I expand a little bit more. Maybe best to use an example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you definitely touched on it.
Yeah. So best example, I think, if you talk, you know, regarding the dynamics between the couple and regarding their interactions with China, I think it could be best illustrated by the gender dynamic. The gender dimension in their perceived, egalitarian society in China. And so they highlighted this gender dynamic. Why? How? And as you can read from the book and learn from the sources, Graham Du Bois was particularly impressed by the elevated standards of Chinese women under the so-called state feminism. Yeah, so therefore, you know, her view obviously influenced her husband. You know, when they were there, you could note Du Bois began to pay more attention to Chinese women as well. Okay, so I'm arguing, you know, yeah, his wife influenced and guided him to see, you know, the new gender relations, the new standards of the women in the new China. And so therefore, Du Bois, you know, influenced by his wife, and began to view China. Before, remember, he talked about, you know, this weak nation. Japan was much better. And the weak nation should accept Japan's tough love and to help expel white colonialism from Asia. And now he began to view China as strong, as harmonious, and the nation was occupied, was lived by robust, strong men and women, okay? So Du Bois observed eventually, you know, I think this is pretty telling. He said, the women of China are becoming free. They wear pets so that they can walk, climb, and dig. And climb and dig they do. They are not dressed simply for sex indulgence or beauty praise. They occupy positions from ministers of state to locomotive engineers, lawyers, doctors, clerks, and laborers, okay? And so confirming this and, you know, reinforcing this. And his wife often, in writings, in speeches, talked about, emphasized, insisted in how Chinese women were more liberated than their black and white sisters.
Mm. Now, given your access to the Chinese language sources, How accurate was her her view, do you think? I don't know if that's a fair question, but...
That's a good question, actually. So here is the visit, right? Perception, but, you know, I think your question is, what is reality, right? So for instance, a lot of people criticize Du Bois, or even Isabella Robinson earlier, Du Bois, a decade later, visited China. A kind of, you know, a perfect picture, right? People happy and prosperous, harmonious. It's a good society. But, you know, keep in mind, during their visit in 1959, China was going through a great leap forward, the disastrous great leap forward, famine, etc. And they didn't say that, or they didn't report that. Okay. Regarding women's status, you know, the state of feminism, it did some improvement, but, you know, not as perfect as, of course, they insisted they described.
Good, thank you. Well, let's get back to Langston Hughes. It's coming to our final questions here. Mm-hmm. And I like the way you describe Langston Hughes, quote, as the first black intellectual mm-hmm. celebrity in China. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit more, because Americans are so obsessed with celebrity.
Okay.
So I'm wondering what the Chinese perception of celebrity, you know, what does that mean in a Chinese context?
Okay. So I think, you know, that's a very good question. I like to talk about Leslie Hughes. I think his story there was fascinating. Okay. So let me first, you know, talk about why I mentioned, you know, Paul Robeson was a celebrity, right? I mentioned he was the most visible, right, as an entertainer back then, before 1949, okay, the communist victory. And so for Leslie Hughes, how he appeared there, you know, he's a radar, you know, became, you know, Chinese became fascinated about him since then. And let me give a little bit of detail about his appearance, okay? And I like this details. In the steamy July of 1933, and Leslie Hughes soldiered from Moscow. Remember, he met Slanchun there, and to incredible, that's the word he used, incredible Shanghai, and we are Japan. Therefore, he actually became the first, as we mentioned many times, Black intellectual celebrity to step on Chinese soil. Okay. And so before him, why he was first intellectual celebrity? Of course, celebrity means the media covered him. You know, his works were translated. He was known and covered, reported on leftist media and also mainstream media. Okay. And so did I mean he was the first Black person appeared in Shanghai? Of course not. Okay. But who were before him? So he recorded this. And of his first impression of Shanghai in his autobiography, I wonder, okay? He said this, I didn't know a soul in the city, means in Shanghai, but hardly had I climbed into a rickshaw, then I saw riding in another along the board a Negro who looked exactly like a Harlemite. I stood up in my rickshaw and yelled, "Hi, man." He stood up in his rickshaw and yelled, "What are you saying?" And we passed each other in the crowded street, and I never saw him again. Okay, so there were Black sojourners population living in Shanghai. Okay, so based on our research sources, who were they before Hughes were there? And so mainly jazz musicians. Okay, so they staffed the nightclubs in China's semi-colonial treaty ports to entertain foreigners and local Chinese, okay? And so that's what, you know, Chinese knew about Blacks, musicians, okay? And so another group actually dominated the presence and the images, even they were not physically there, but in the mind, the local people's mind, were athletes. Why athletes? And because back then, China was humiliated as a with the nickname Sick Man of Asia, right? So they were alarmed by the rise of nationalism and Japan's imperial ambition. So therefore, under that concept, as you could understand, China's performance, their athletes' performance, you know, we have an Olympic ongoing right now, you know, what it could be like, you know, the competition among nations, you know, that Chinese athletes were defeated badly, continuously, in the 1932 and 1936 Olympics. Okay, and so under this context, and Chinese media began to cite and loud and applaud the so-called quote-unquote natural physical prowess of Black athletes, including the boxer Joe Louis. And also, of course, the track and field star Jesse Owens. Why they reported covered those athletes? Because they believed they could reflect the power and threats for the colored people together. Okay. So that what I'm saying so far is up to the point where Leslie Hughes appeared on Chinese soil, and all Chinese people knew about. But Black people were musicians and athletes. So remember, and so those two personas, musical and athletic personas, were closely connected to the stereotypical African primitivism. Nothing else you can do but play music and do athletic stuff. Okay. So under this context, you know the meaning of letting Weston Hughes appears and covered by media as a celebrity. What kind of celebrity? And using his brain, an intellectual, a writer. So therefore, I argue his appearance in Shanghai, in China, began to help to revolutionize the image of Blacks over there by foregrounding his intellectual capacity as opposed to, as I mentioned, the other athletic and musical personas.
Right, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Well, we come to the end of our conversation, but I want to ask you one more question in regards to your future research or current research. What do you have next in terms of books?
Too many.
A lot of ideas come out of this alone.
Yeah. Okay. So so far, right now, I'm finishing a biography. I mentioned two biographies I'm working on. One is pretty close to finish. So this is a biography. Her name was Su Yang. Okay, she was born in Hawaii, and she played in many Hollywood films, but as a supporting actress. She played, for instance, in Good Earth. So that's the most famous one. And most importantly, I would show in this book about transnational history still, right? Transnational, trans-Pacific. And she had connection with the intellectual network, different from other actress. And actually, she got a master degree. And she got a bachelor degree from the University of Hawaii. And then she got a master degree at the University of Columbia. Started with John Dewey. Okay? And she appeared in Broadway, etc. She connected with the Trans-Pacific intellectual network from Nankai University, Tsinghua University, and also China Institute in New York City. And also she interpreted for Milan from the King of Beijing Opera during her tour in the U.S. in 1930. So basically I'm trying to show, the transnational network she entered, and also highly educated. That's kind of unusual for Chinese, for women, etc. How that, altered and changed the image and dynamics. So that's one of the biographies. Another is called Wang Ying. She was from China, and she soldiered to the U.S. During the Second World War II as Liu Liangmo, and she worked with Paul Robeson as well.
So it seems like this book alone has given you so many new avenues to look at transnational history, transcultural histories.
Yeah. After that, maybe I started work on what we talk about Surrey Graham Du Bois and Isleta Robeson and their interactions with China and Chinese. Actually, I found too many materials to be just included in this book as enough actually for a second project. Maybe that's a project after.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today and discussing your important book, Arise Africa, Roar China.
Thank you so much for having me here. I hope the listeners, the reader, would enjoy my book. Thank you.
I'm sure they will. Thank you.